second case, which we'll hear oral argument this morning, is number 06-1494, Baker Hughes v. Reed Hycalog. Mr. Mangum.
That's right. Thank you.
Okay. And you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, correct?
I have, Your Honor. Thank you very much. May it please the Court, my name is David Mangum. I represent the appellant Baker Hughes Oilfield Operations Inc. In light of the Supreme Court's decision in MedImmune and the subsequent decisions of this Court applying the MedImmune standard, the District Court's dismissal of the case based upon a found absence of subject matter jurisdiction cannot stand. I would like to spend, with the Court's indulgence, my time talking about the alternative holding where the Court purported to suggest that he would dismiss the case under discretionary grounds, even if he were to find that there was subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, Mr. Mann, let me ask you, though, on the first point, certainly you're correct. The landscape was radically changed by, I guess, most particularly footnote 11 in MedImmune versus Genentech. And we recognize that in Sandisk and Teva. But that said, isn't there a reasonable argument here for the proposition that we should let the district court in the first instance decide what I'll call the Article III case or controversy issue, recognizing it also would have to address jurisdiction if it found a controversy? Because, I mean, you've really got three bodies of evidence here on Article III, I think. You've got the letter that was sent from Reed Hycalog to the Baker Hughes subsidiary that we know about that's in the record. Then we have, and that letter speaks for itself. Then we have, though, conflicting evidence on what happened in a subsequent telephone conversation, correct?
Correct.
Then we have, finally, this also some question about what this Reed Hycalog representative told someone from the Kuwaiti oil ministry or whatever it was. So, don't those conflicting facts have to be sorted out in order to make a determination on an Article III issue before you got to the discretionary issue?
Well, I think, Your Honor,
sorry to go on for so long.
No, absolutely not a problem. I think the evidence, and under the MedImmune standard, there's clearly substantial evidence to support that there is a substantial and concrete controversy here in terms of they have patents, those patents have issued, we are selling devices that have this polycrystalline diamond compact in it that they allege infringe on their patents. And so we have a concrete controversy that has been raised, and you don't really, regardless of the resolution of those additional facts, there is a concrete controversy under Article III of the Constitution because they have issued patents that they have put
in
mind.
So you hang your hat solely on that letter?
I think, Your Honor, in terms of the test is a totality of the circumstances test. And we don't any longer require reasonable apprehension, although I think there's substantial and sufficient facts for there to have been a reasonable apprehension of a patent infringement.
The letter simply said, here are these patents, and also it was sent out to, I think, more than just your client's subsidiary, isn't that correct?
It was sent out to everyone in the industry that that has these PDC, polycrystalline diamond compact cutters, and that uses them. And in fact, it was sent to U.S. Synthetic, who also brought a declaratory judgment action. It was sent to U.S. Synthetic's customers, who are now joined in the litigation.
You know, I sent out, I'm sorry, I said I sent out. I'm listening to you. I I brought MedImmune versus Genentech because I want to make sure I got this right. The court said there, our decisions have required that the dispute be definite and concrete, touching the legal relations of parties having adverse legal interests, and that it be real and substantial and admit of specific relief through a decree, etc. Now, are you what you're necessarily saying, Mr. Mann, is that that letter that was sent out by Reed Hycalog to your client sub and other people met that requirement? And that I realize there are business subtleties here, but isn't that reading a lot into that letter to say that it meets that requirement?
Well, I think, Your Honor, there's a combination of the letter, there's the subsequent communications with regard to
it. You have a dispute in the communication.
But you don't have a dispute with regard to, the only aspect with regard to a dispute on that communication regards specific conduct with the statement about U.S. Synthetics infringes, you're buying U.S. Synthetics cutters, therefore we're going to sue. There's no dispute with regard to statements that they said, these patents are our crown jewels. There's no dispute with regard to statements that we intend to vigorously enforce these patents against the industry. So we have a concrete controversy here. Article 3, I believe, Your Honor, is clearly satisfied. And then on top of that, you know, you have the facts where they then end up in the marketplace making statements through their agents Yes, there's dispute with regard to aspects of the communication.
Doesn't your case, though, from what you're saying, you're making your argument probably, that necessarily doesn't your case say that, come down to the bedrock principle you're arguing for, is that if Company A has a patent and it sends a letter to Company B that is in the industry and says, here's this patent, we understand you make widget X, that's enough?
I believe that is enough.
But that's what you're saying.
I do. That's not what's necessary to reach this decision.
Under 11 law.
Absolutely. If you have a patent, and in fact, I think, Your Honor, really, if you look at footnote 11 of MedImmune, you can have a circumstance where a patent has issued, someone takes the position that there is a plausible interpretation of that patent that covers their product, and that can create.
You mean without any action on the patentee at all?
I think, Your Honor, there are circumstances. I mean, we have, for example, in the case where someone publishes their patent in the Orange Book, and you have a product that you think arguably comes within that the scope of that patent, I think that can create a justiciable controversy under the MedImmune decision. I think that MedImmune's decision is very broad with regard to when there's a concrete controversy. If there's a patent out there, and you believe your patent can legitimately, that the patent could be interpreted to cover your product, I think, and in fact, I think there's a reference in some of this court's decisions, if you send a quote-unquote put-up-or-shut-up letter to the patent owner, and the patent owner does not respond and say, we do not believe that you infringe, we are giving you a covenant not to sue, or denying that there's any infringement here, that can create a justiciable controversy under the MedImmune decision.
But this letter was not a put-up-or-shut-up letter. This was a letter saying, you make certain things, and we have these patents.
And you should be aware of these patents, yes. And then that...
We wish to bring, to quote it, we therefore wish to bring to your attention the following patents, and they list the patents.
And then certainly there are other decisions where the here's some patents that may be of interest to you, is the letter. But what that leads to, Your Honor, is then an inquiry made by the president of Hughes Christensen, where to contact the president and say, well, I've received this letter from you. And then they have a discussion. And while there's a dispute about some of the specifics of that communication, there is no dispute that he informed Mr. Burgess that these patents were important patents to them, that they were considered the crown jewels of the company, and that they were going to vigorously enforce those. The only dispute is with regard to how much investigation had been done by Reed Hycalog at that point with regard to actually examining the accused devices. But with that communication and the indication that they would vigorously enforce those patents, I believe under MedImmune there was now a concrete controversy.
So let me ask you this. Suppose, and this is obviously a hypothetical, but suppose upon receiving that letter, your client had written a letter back saying, Thank you very much. We want to consider your letter. We'll respond to you in 30 days. Okay? Now, assume that was all you had.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the situation then that you said? Would there be what I'll call a Article III case of controversy as the Supreme Court has spelled it out at that point in time?
Well, there are subsequent, I think with regard to some of the decisions, that it's possible, depending upon the accused device and the person's position with regard to their accused device. You have several cases that have been decided by this court, the Genentech case, electronics for imaging case, the Capo case are examples, where you have a deadline set where there's going to be a discussion, and you say, well, if you don't enter into negotiations.
I'm posing the hypothetical where your client writes back and says, thank you, we've received this letter, we appreciate you bringing these patents to our attention, we're going to look at our product, and we will respond to you in 30 days. A very non-confrontational response to the letter that was sent to him.
Well, I think
at that point, would you say that under what the Supreme Court has said, there's enough?
There could be if the party then looks at its product and decides that there is a plausible interpretation of the claims of that patent that would encompass their product. I don't believe that the defendant in that circumstance, or the accused person, would have the obligation to go back and say, well, we've looked at this and we believe that while there may be a plausible interpretation of your patent that covers our device, we don't believe that's the proper interpretation, and has to wait for then some other response from the patent owner. I think if the person then looks at that materials and says there is a plausible interpretation of this patent, we don't believe it's the correct interpretation of this patent that could potentially encompass our device, they could bring a declaratory judgment action.
Well, taking the hypothetical one step further, if they engaged counsel and counsel's opinion was that the alleged infringer at this point, this device does not infringe the patent, no infringement. At that point, is there a case of controversy?
Well, I think you have facts like that in some of these cases. Well, you don't have to concede that you infringe. That opinion letter, for example, Your Honor, could say that there are multiple possible interpretations of the claim to this patent. We believe that the proper interpretation of this patent is this, 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 and this. Under that interpretation, you would not infringe. But I don't think that removes the possibility of a case of controversy, because we all know that the claim construction issue can go different ways. I think the MedImmune decision and the subsequent decisions that have been issued by this court very effectively broaden the situation under which somebody can be bringing a DJ action. And I think any patent owner that puts someone on notice of their patents and that person or entity has a product on the market that potentially comes within the scope of that patent, that they have created the possibility of a declaratory judgment action. I notice that I'm now into my rebuttal time. If I could briefly, with regard to the discretionary issue, the pattern in this court's decision since MedImmune has been to reverse or vacate and remand and allow the district court to again exercise its discretion or to apply the facts. I believe in the circumstances of this case that there's a clear abuse of discretion with regard to the court's purported exercise of its discretionary authority in two respects. One, there was no evidence in the record to justify the court's analysis in suggesting that there were ongoing negotiations or a possibility of settlement. And if this district court's decision is upheld based upon this exercise of discretion, in every case, there's a possibility of some settlement. Here, there was no evidence in the record, no affidavit or declaration that established that there were ongoing negotiations. In fact, the facts are uncontroverted that at the time the declaratory judgment action was filed, there had been, there were no discussions towards settlement or a licensing of the patent. Second, I believe the district court's reference to this court's decision, the UMC case, well stretches that case. That case was a circumstance where the court found that there were ongoing settlement discussions and negotiations towards licensing, and that the DJ action was filed for the purpose of leveraging those negotiations. In this circumstance, when Reed Hycalog files the patent infringement case 5.5 hours after inducing the district court to dismiss its case, the proper analysis should focus on where this case was first filed, and the case should proceed ultimately to trial in Utah. And I believe there are circumstances and procedures available for the court to deal with the judicial economy interest to the extent there may be a case still going forward in the Eastern District of Texas. And in particular, one way that this could be resolved is the same way that you do under a 1407 situation, where the cases could remain consolidated in the Eastern District of Texas for the pretrial and claim construction proceedings. And then when and if it comes time for trial, the case could be then sent to the Utah District Court, the first filed case, for purposes of trial.
Could I ask you just a quick factual question? If you can
absolutely
not about this against time. The declaration of Dan Scott, which is the declaration through which the conversation in question comes in, recites, it's not a direct declaration of one of the parties to the conversation. Instead, it recites a second conversation between Mr. Scott and Mr. Burgess, who was a party to them.
Correct.
There's a reference to Mr. Burgess as being, at the time, the president of HCC. Is Mr. Burgess unavailable?
Mr. Burgess is no longer affiliated with Baker Hughes. He's still alive, but Mr. Burgess was not willing to provide an affidavit because he did not want to get involved with people.
I understand. That's
thank you, Mr.
Mayor. Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll restore your rebuttals. You had a number of questions. We'll hear from Reed Hycalog. Mr. Hatch?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Hatch, representing the Reed Hycalog defendants. Just as a point to Your Honor's question, the last question, I think what Mr. Mangum has indicated to you is somewhat inaccurate. He may not be there now, but at the time of that declaration, my understanding is he was employed there, and that's what I think we found so amazing about that declaration, is that it was they didn't get it from their own employee. And if he wasn't an employee, he was somehow still under a contract, a consulting contract or something with them. He had a relationship.
I take it from the context, it appears he wasn't the president.
I think he's, as we understood it from talking, we tried to talk to him as well to see what had happened, because it was inconsistent with what, his testimony was inconsistent with what was told to, what our employees understood. And
so
he wouldn't talk to us because he still had some ongoing financial relationship with Baker Hughes.
This really goes to a broader question, I think.
Sure.
What the extent to which there is a dispute about the contents of this, I take it that nobody disputes that there was a conversation between Mr. Dean and Mr. Burgess.
No, as a matter of fact, as you know, we in the record, we submitted an affidavit from Mr. Dean indicating what actually was talked about.
Right. Okay.
And what he says was talked about is rather significant, and I think it's somewhat consistent with Your Honor's concurring opinion in Sandus, because you used the put up or shut up language. And that's exactly what happened here, according to Mr. Dean. Now, understand, this is an affidavit that's well before Sandus, back when the test was reasonable apprehension. And Mr. Dean said that I informed him, meaning Mr. Burgess, and this is at A77 in the record, that Reed Hycalog had not looked into the matter and was unaware of any infringement by HCC, which is the Baker Hughes subsidiary. Says, I'm unaware of any infringement. I mean, that's the exact question Your Honor said you should ask them to determine whether there is a concrete controversy. And apparently that was discussion. He specifically said at that time, we had not looked into the matter, unaware of any infringement by Baker Hughes. I further stated that the purpose of the standard notice letter was merely to inform Baker Hughes of the existence of Reed Hycalog's patents. My conversation with Mr. Burgess was cordial and no litigation was threatened or suggested. That's what the record is. And I think Judge Holderman raised the issue of the letter itself. And the letter itself, we're getting dangerously close. I understand that we've taken a step back from reasonable apprehension because of the MedImmune decision and now this court's decision in SanDisk. But now we're being asked to step down one more and essentially say, if you have a patent and we have a product, and subjectively we're going to worry about whether there's a controversy. So our subjective belief is enough to create an Article III case of controversy. And I don't think that really can possibly be the standard.
Yes, it does seem that there's no question that, footnote 11 in MedImmune radically changed the landscape. And not to tip my hand, but it seems to me it would be very difficult for us to just flat out affirm this case, given the new environment, if you will. Don't we have to send it back for some purpose? Now, the question is, do we send it back? And I'm just speaking for myself, not when I say we, not my panel colleagues. Do we send it back for the judge to make an Article III case of controversy determination and then look at discretion, or do we just send it back for discretion?
Well, I have a couple ways to approach that, Your Honor. One is, I think based on the record here, and let me start by saying, I don't know that we necessarily need to say that the MedImmune case forced a radical departure, particularly if applied to the facts of this case. In the MedImmune case, of course, there were contractual dealings between the parties, there were extensive negotiations, there was a request to pay royalties, or,
One thing in footnote 11 in MedImmune that did away with our reasonable apprehension of suit test, and then, as we've talked about it, SanDisk was the important.
Well, that's right. Then I go to SanDisk, and SanDisk is a case, of course, as Your Honor is aware, where there were allegations of specific products, specific infringement. The parties engaged in extensive negotiations where the elements of claims were mapped out. There was an actual controversy there. I think this court can find, based on this record, that there is no such thing, even if the test is different. And clearly, the district court applied the test that existed at the time. But even applying the test, as we understand it from MedImmune and SanDisk, here, we have to look at the facts themselves. One, we have a letter. The letter has no mention of a threat. It is only a notice letter of patents. And the interesting thing here is, this has been sent to everybody in the industry. And yes, eventually some of these parties have been sued, but some of them have not been. And a letter of that nature in this industry where you have a patent can also be akin to simply a marketing tool. And I don't think that...
Marketing a potential license?
For products. For instance, Baker Hughes here does not make PVCs. They buy them from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to say, I have a patent because I have a new way of doing it that's better than what everybody else has, that's a marketing tool. And I don't think this court should ever get to the point where it says just mentioning patents creates a case of controversy, particularly where they're a customer, where it certainly could be the intent and the expectation that we've got something better, we hope Baker Hughes buys our stuff. We've got a new patent, it's good stuff.
So this was a selling device?
Well, I'm not specifically saying it is or it isn't, but I'm saying is, if as a matter of law the test is you just send a letter and mention four patents, and that's enough to create a controversy to someone who's a customer of, in this case, PDCs, then where's the line? At that point, it's just owning a patent means anybody can sue you at any time if they have a subjective belief that they infringe a product. And I don't think that's the test. Certainly, Matt Newton didn't go that far.
Now, you go get to the conversation, because that's what actually concerns me the most. And there is, you're right, the two versions of the conversation don't exactly meet up. But it seems to me that it is at least not inconsistent that, Mr. Dean's affidavit, I guess, is not inconsistent with Mr. Scott's version of Mr. Burgess's account of the conversation to this extent. Correct me if I'm getting this wrong in your view, but at least there's nothing in Mr. Dean's affidavit that disclaims his having referred to the other parties in the industry having being subject to being guilty of infringement of the Reed High Club patents, correct?
I think he specifically set that up, said that he didn't do that.
Well, I'm not talking now about saying that with respect to...
You're talking about other people.
Other people, yeah. I mean, the argument that Mr. Scott, the issue that Mr. Scott raises is, did he say in this conversation, other people, such as USS, are infringing, and by the way, they're providing these PDCs to a lot of other people, with the implication being that those people to whom they are providing the PDCs are also, by using those PDCs, infringing.
Without actually saying. Yeah, two things I would like to say about that. One is I think that's inaccurate. If you look again at his affidavit in the appendix 77. Yeah, in paragraph 11, Mr. Dean specifically says, I never engaged in a conversation or any type of communication with anyone at Baker Hughes, in which I stated that I had collected PDCs from various PD manufacturers and believed that the manufacturers of those PDCs were infringing on PAC. So specifically says he didn't do that. And then two, in paragraph 15, he says he's not been authorized to file any patent infringement lawsuits. And so the clear implication of both of those is that he hasn't said those things. And the more amazing thing, and the reason I think this court, getting back to something Judge Schall said, because I still haven't completely answered your question, is why I think this court has enough of a record to rule, they know that this doesn't reach the test, is Mr. Scott's affidavit really doesn't put that at issue. This isn't even really admissible evidence of any kind. I mean, he is trying to say...
Hearsay?
Well, it's clearly hearsay. He says Trevor Burgess, the president of... Since ACC at the time telephoned Mr. Dean. Within a few hours, Mr. Burgess relayed the contents of the conversation to me, he says. So it's clearly he's not a party to it, he didn't hear it, and he's now saying something that Mr. Burgess, who they had access to at the time, could have told him. And then this is what he says to get at that point, they're trying to establish reasonable apprehension of suit. He says, in the conversation in which Mr. Burgess relayed to me the substance of the telephone call with Mr. Dean, it was apparent to me by the manner in which Mr. Burgess reacted to Mr. Dean's statements, that Mr. Burgess believed that Reed Hycalog intended to sue drill bit manufacturers. So here's what we're creating, an actual concrete controversy.
The argument be that he was so agitated that something must have been said. The conversation wasn't come over to have lunch with me, it was something more ominous.
Well, he could have said something about his mother. I mean, who knows?
No, but that isn't really, it seems to me, that's fluffy. I agree with you. It's the prior paragraph 6B and C that seems to me contain the grist, to the extent that there's grist here, of the argument that there's this sort of indirect assertion of infringement. That is to say, according to Scott's version of Burgess's,
you're right,
that Dean said there are people out there making this stuff, it infringes, and therefore those people out there, we don't know if you're one of them, but who buy it, are also infringing.
I set up the response to your question slightly differently because I emphasize the hearsay portions of
right.
this because that can't be evidence. So I'm saying this whole affidavit really can't be evidence to establish the controversy. And then I pointed out that as to those questions, those statements that he made, hearsay statements at B and C, that Mr. Dean, who was a part of the conversation, did submit an affidavit as evidence that no such things were ever talked about. So we're really trying, in essence... And if you put this in context, I don't know if your honors got this from the record, but another suit had been brought before this, and largely this is, to a certain degree, appears to be another manufacturer, USS, who I think Baker Hughes has bought PDCs from in the past, potentially trying to manufacture some type of controversy. Because they're going out and they're getting hearsay declarations, they're taking a letter that does nothing more than a form of patent and say, here we've got a potential lawsuit. Now the interesting thing here too is they've sued on, and this goes part to I think the discretionary aspect of this and some of the practical effects of what happens now that a lawsuit is going forward in Texas, is they've sued on 12 patents. You'll notice the letter to them only had 4 patents, and the lawsuit against them in Texas is only on 4 patents.
These same 4?
I believe so. I have to look. I think so. But that raises the question, Your Honor. I mean, he's raised whatever compulsory counterclaim. You know, that aside, where is the substantial controversy on the other eight? Where did they get that from? They don't even have a letter on the other eight. It was only on four. So they have to derive that from somewhere else. But where? The only lawsuit is on the four. So, you know, this is an appellant here who is trying to get this court to take MedImmune from, you know, a set of facts that had a considerable amount of actual concrete controversy under Article 3. This court's now, footnote 11, redefined it in the Sandisk case in a fact situation where there really was a really concrete controversy. And I kind of wrote it down in layman's terms. I mean, it seems like the prior test was you had, here was a patent, we think you infringed, and we're going to sue you. And the new test seems to be, here's a patent, and here's your product, and, you know, we want to license you. You know, it doesn't have to be, it has to be almost the same as a suit, because that's what happened in Sandisk. They could have said, we want to sue you, but they say, we want a license. Or we're laying out the elements, we're mapping out the elements in negotiations. So there's a concrete. The only thing here was here's a patent. And we have some hearsay statements. And we didn't talk about the statements of the alleged 280 guy. But, it's so fanciful. I mean, it wouldn't be evidence that would stand up if we were trying this case. And if anything, it would be hotly contradicted. So then we get to, what I think is still an important issue, and it's the discretion of the court. Because one thing that MedImmune didn't do is it didn't take away the discretion of the court. And MedImmune, I think at pages, I think it's 776 to 777, MedImmune even re-emphasized the district court's discretion on equitable and prudential grounds that even if there is a controversy.
Yes, let me ask you though, assume for the moment one were to conclude, Mr. Mangum says that we should just flat out reverse and not even have consideration of discretion. But assume for the moment one were to send the case back and say there is an Article 3 case of controversy. Wouldn't the judge have to say in that circumstance why he was exercising discretion not to sue, not to entertain the suit? I mean, because here, the record here, as I recall, he just said, and in any event, I would find, as a matter of discretion, that I wouldn't entertain the suit. Doesn't have to be some kind of a explanation as to why discretion is or is not being exercised in a particular way?
Well, I think I answered two parts, and may I continue?
Oh, yeah, fine. We'll let you, because Mr. Mangum is getting some additional time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd say two things. One is the court had indicated that it was aware that there were extrajudicial dispute resolution processes going on. Mr. Mangum questions that on an evidentiary basis in his briefs and in his oral argument. The reality is that representation was made to the court in oral argument. They did not dispute that. And so they're trying to put some odd evidentiary obligation on us to prove that we didn't have these negotiations when they've never denied it. They know that they've happened, and it was discussed openly with the court. The EMC case, in particular, and there's been nothing to overrule that's not a good basis for the court to exercise its discretion. So I think here we already have the court, a proper basis for the court to make that discretion. I think if it were to be sent back, but I think your honors can certainly take judicial notice of that, is the policy behind a declaratory judgment action is to remove unnecessary uncertainty and delay by a lawsuit if there is some controversy by being put off for a period of time that might injure the rights of another party. Now, while we deny that was an occurrence here, the fact that there is ongoing litigation in Texas over these same patents and same issues would indicate that the policy behind a declaratory judgment action has already been resolved. And
in that regard, this case has, like Sandisk, has started the smell of a dispute over form more than anything else. And a lot of things played out in San Antonio.
Well, a lot of people bring DJ actions for that, just that purpose. I don't think you can smear either side with that, because I think...
No, that's right. But I think it's hard to say which way this cuts. Each of you has argued that the filing of the lawsuit shortly after the resolution of the jurisdictional dispute cuts in its favor. And I felt the same way at the end of Sandy, except what everybody was all excited about wasn't really what's at issue in the DJ, it was form.
Well, that's one fact that they have that's kind of sexy, is that there was a suit filed shortly
exactly
after.
Exactly the same thing happened in Sandy's.
Yeah, and I understand that. But let me say it this way, looking at it as a practical matter. This Baker Hughes brought this declaratory judgment action as a customer, not as a manufacturer, as one of the mainline people that would normally have been gone after. It's very likely that they brought themselves into this and got themselves sued in Texas because they made an issue of it, because I don't think they would have normally been a frontline person. But the case in Texas, as a practical matter, is the same things, and it has other parties in it which can't be brought to, which aren't going to be brought to Utah, and that case is going to go forward. And so what they're asking for is, let's do it in two different places. He said, well, we can do the pretrial stuff there and then bring it to Utah. You can't do that. The USS is in there. Halliburton's in there. USS is their supplier. They inevitably have to be there because of the fact that it's their cutters that are at issue here. And Mr. Manning's going to say, well, you know, bifurcate us out. Try them in Texas and us in Utah. Well, where is the practical reason there? And where is the policy behind it? Declaratory judgment action that gets you that type of a relief. I don't think there's any. And so as a matter of practicality, I think these are all matters that are before Your Honor, that are made part of the record. I think this court has enough to affirm on the new standard and on discretion, the lower court below. But I agree, it's always an option to remand them to decide these things, but you know, they're here now before you, and I think you have the power to do what's necessary. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Well, one further question, maybe just a quick factual question. I think in your brief you point out that the hearsay laden declaration is the way you characterize the Scott declaration, and you say it was disputed as unreliable as such. This was a point that you raised in the district court, the hearsay nature of the Scott declaration.
Yeah, we raised everything. I think that in the briefing and in the oral argument, because I mean that was a hot issue, because we disputed very hotly the fact that Mr. Dean ever said that. That's why we filed the affidavit.
Right. I guess my question is, did you argue that it was hearsay, and did the court respond in any way to the hearsay?
Yeah,
I don't recall.
The court responded in this way, and I think it's in his decision, I'm not going to get to it right away, but I think he tried to read the facts in the light most favorable to them, and I believe at one point he said, I'll take the facts as you're saying it to decide them in a reasonable apprehension, but I find your version of the facts to be somewhat misleading, I think was the exact word that the judge used. And so the judge didn't spell it out because it wasn't necessary under the old standard for him to do that, but it was considered.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Manning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have your rebuttal. Let me respond to a couple of statements. One is, with regard to the letters, there are two letters that cover all 12 patents. The letters are at A177 in the appendix, and 179 and 80. The first letter covers nine patents. The last one covers three plus some pending application. So all 12 of the patents that are the subject of the DJ action in Utah were part of the letters. The reference to suggest that U.S. Synthetics is Baker Hughes' supplier, it's not accurate. U.S. Synthetics supplies Halliburton. Baker Hughes' supplier is a company out of Ireland. Baker Hughes is the company that has the largest market share with regard to PDC, so any suggestions that they were not the target in this litigation strategy is inaccurate as well. With regard to the Scott Declaration, to respond to Judge Bryson's suggestion, there was an argument made about it being hearsay, but the court took those facts as established and said, even finding all the facts and the suggestion of Baker Hughes, that he would find that there was no jurisdiction.
It does appear to be, so you wouldn't contest that.
I don't contest at all that it is. What the relevant, the reason we submitted it, besides the fact that Mr. Burgess was not available, he would not give us a declaration because he just flat out did not want to get involved.
Was he still working for you at
no.
the time?
No, he's not employed by the company.
He was at the time of the declaration?
Not employed at the time of the declaration.
And not otherwise retained by the company in any capacity?
He had some continuing compensation with regard to the company from his being the former president, but was not employed, not our agent, not anyone that we had control over. And I think the importance of the Scott Declaration as well is it's reflective of what the conduct of Reed Hycalite caused within Baker Hughes. They started to prepare for patent litigation the same as if an express threat of patent infringement had been made.
That seems to me pretty thin soup. I mean, if you've got somebody who gets all flustered at virtually nothing, that can't really be a stronger basis for a declaratory judgment action than somebody who is a little hardier and doesn't get easily flustered.
But what I think the declaration reflects, and I think the way to resolve this, is if you take, as the court was doing, if you take those two declarations and you look at the aspects where the declarations do not dispute each other, I mean, Mr. Scott's declaration is out there. There is a response from Mr. Dean. So Mr. Dean knows exactly what he's responding to. And if you look at Mr. Dean's declaration in light of what Dan Scott says, there are aspects of what Dan Scott reports about that communication, which is hearsay. Burgess told me this. There are aspects of that conversation that Mr. Dean does not deny. He does not deny that they were told that these patents were the crown jewels of the company and that they were going to vigorously pursue and enforce those patents. Now, the other thing, and to respond to Judge Schall's comment about remand and what would be available on remand, the record does not contain, because the record was only established at a certain level. We've proceeded with the litigation in Texas, and I can report to the court that on remand, there will be additional evidence from the files of Reed Hycalite that draw into question some of the declaration statements of Mr. Dean with regard to what type of examination had been done about the U.S. synthetics cutters and also about the Baker Hughes equipment. So there is substantial information that will bring to bear on the issue of both the actual case or controversy and on the exercise of discretion. And I just submit, with regard to the exercise of discretion, it cannot be the law that as long as there is a possibility of settlement, that the district court has the ability to say, I don't want to hear this case. This court had made it clear in the Genentech case and also in the case of Electronics for Imaging that there is an obligation on the part of the district court to hear cases or controversy that are before them. There's also a strong presumption in favor of the forum in which the case is first filed. What's happened here is that Reed Hycalite, rather than facing the forum issue straight up and saying, in either moving the district court in Utah to transfer the case to the Eastern District of Texas, which, by the way, there's absolutely no connection between this lawsuit and the Eastern District of Texas.
There seems to be a connection between the Eastern District of Texas and every patent case.
There is. But U.S. Synthetics is located in Utah. Hughes Christensen division of Baker Hughes, which is now in Houston, was previously in Utah, and that is where many of the witnesses and others are. But there's no connection to the Eastern District of Texas. It's not Reed Hycalite's home forum. It's not U.S. Synthetics' home forum. It's not Halliburton's home forum. It's not Baker Hughes' home forum. And what's happened?
Mr. Mangum, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your time is up. I think we have the arguments. Thank you, Mr. Hatch. I thank you. Case is submitted.